It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is a powerhouse in many competitive areas, including an academic contest for middle and high school students. We'll find out how the Madison team fared in this year's African American History Challenge Bowl. Now, in a letter submitted to staff at the State Department of Veterans Affairs, Secretary Dan Zimmerman announced that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs had not renewed a grant that provides funding for a program that assists homeless veterans in the state. In light of that news and the ongoing audits into conditions at hospitals that serve veterans in Wisconsin, four state lawmakers have sent a letter to Zimmerman to implore him to find the funding needed to bolster these services. Representative Katrina Shanklin was one of the co-signers of the letter. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. Representative Shanklin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why did the Joint Finance Committee reach out to Veterans Affairs Secretary Dan Zimmerman?
So my Democratic colleagues and I wrote a letter to the secretary to have a vital conversation about our veterans, including not only the veterans' home at King and the needed capital improvements we absolutely must invest in, but also the other programs that we want to see funds for released immediately. The budget is about a month late now. You know, it's 25 days past due, so we're getting closer and closer to an impasse that not only will affect our roads and our schools and our local governments, but also will affect the people of Wisconsin. And we want immediate action on investing in our veterans. So we requested that the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs file a 1310 request with the Committee on Finance. So what that does is it essentially allows us to release the funds immediately, which we believe is not only necessary, but urgent.
So let's kind of unpack that a little. You mentioned the veterans' home at King. There have certainly been a lot of news stories about that. There have been audits of that veterans' home. What has come out of those audits that you feel really needs to be addressed immediately?
The audits have shown that there are serious issues at King. And in fact, the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau is still conducting an audit right now on King. But what we found from investigative reporting, particularly from the Cap Times, is that there has been questionable drinking water. You know, the drinking water was yellow. There have been moldy walls, stained floors, potentially unsafe equipment. We believe that when it comes to the water supply, the electrical substation replacement, and just the capital improvements that are needed at King, that we need to release those dollars right now. And that comes about to $12 million to make some improvements to King. We think there should be even more than that. But that's one piece of the puzzle here. And while we wait for the results of the final audit from the Legislative Audit Bureau, we also believe we need to have a conversation about King's homeless veterans program that's about to be completely phased out, just like it is at Union Grove. And we want to have that conversation with the secretary as well so we can discuss ways to invest in that so our homeless veterans have a place to go.
So just so I'm clear, my understanding is that with the budget not passed for the new biennium, that we're under kind of a continuing budget. Basically, things are being funded as they were in the previous, but these capital requests, that's a separate pot of money that action needs to be taken to be available.
Right. So it's included in the budget. We did vote to allow that to go forward, but we want that money released immediately. And that's why we're asking the secretary to come before us to request it, because we believe we can get that money out sooner. And as this budget impasse continues to happen, we think we need to have even more conversations about veterans programs and ways that we can help our veterans right now. I'm worried that this goes into the fall. And, you know, the longer you wait to make capital improvements, the greater the cost when you're doing infrastructure investments. And it also just speaks to the uncertainty that the budget impasse creates. People across the state are wondering what's going to happen to the budget, and we want to show our commitment to our veterans. And that's why Joint Finance Committee Democrats wrote this letter to Secretary Zimmerman.
And that program that provides support for homeless veterans, and that funding is going away, how many veterans are affected by that or could potentially access that program were it to be continued?
I think it's under 100. I think there are about 30 or so at one of the veterans' homes, 19 at another. I'm not sure about the third one, Chippewa Falls. That program is still continuing, but two of the three veterans' homes, King and Union Grove, will no longer have that homeless veterans program. And what I've discussed discovered is, you know, the state knew about this in December. They knew that we weren't going to be getting these grants from the VA for homeless providers. So my question is, we already voted on the Veterans Affairs part of the budget. Why wasn't the Finance Committee notified? Why wasn't the entire state legislature notified? Why didn't the governor put contingency funds to support our homeless veterans in the budget? Or later, why didn't he amend the budget or suggest it to the Finance Committee? Why didn't Secretary Zimmerman, when he came before us this spring for agency briefings, bring this up? He knew that certain grants would be terminated. Why didn't he request funds? Why? I have so many questions about why we had many opportunities as a state to invest in our homeless veterans program, but until the press reported it, many of us were left in the dark. And
so, to be clear, even though the budget has not been passed as a whole, the part that affects veterans has already been voted on. So people might be wondering, well, if the budget's still up in the air, it can be corrected, but it sounds like that's not the case.
It absolutely can, though, and I'm glad you brought that up. Today, we're requesting, as Democratic members of the Joint Committee on Finance, to our co-chairs, Representative Nygren and Senator Darling, the co-chairs of the Finance Committee, that we immediately meet and reconvene to reopen the DVA. It's a simple motion. I could just say, I move to open the DVA budget again. We could open it up. We could introduce one motion to fund the homeless veterans programs at all three veterans homes in the state. It would be, you know, about $1 million that we're talking about here. The state DVA has already said they can only fund this program until the end of 2017. So my question is, what is going to happen next? And why wasn't there groundwork being made when they knew in December that this could potentially happen? And now that they got the notification that they won't receive the federal funds, why shouldn't the state invest? So let's reopen. Everybody's waiting for the budget to pass. It's clear there's a transportation budget impasse. It's clear they're arguing over taxes and education. So why don't we meet to discuss veterans? Let's make that our next first vote. Why don't we invest in our veterans care? Why don't we ask the committee to release the funds to the Secretary of DVA to invest in King? And why don't we make sure our homeless veterans have a place to go?
We're talking with Representative Katrina Shanklin. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. And we're talking about the letter that she and fellow Democrats from the Joint Finance Committee sent to Veterans Affairs Secretary Dan Zimmerman, looking to release funds to support programs for veterans. Representative Shanklin, what are you hearing from your district, from veterans in your district? What are they saying that they need in support in a variety of programs?
People continue to question why there's even a debate on whether or not we should invest in veterans and how much. These people have given everything to their country, and they believe that at a minimum, we should be investing in King immediately. They wonder why it's taken so long to get these needed capital improvements. They're certainly concerned about the raids of the King Veterans Home dollars being transferred over to other parts of the Veterans Affairs budget. And many people are concerned about the staffing shortages, the significant overtime at King. Since I live right next to, my district is right next to the district that houses King, I certainly hear from workers who are concerned as well about the need to invest in King, and they want what's best for veterans. So I think that this is a no-brainer. I believe that there should be strong bipartisan support. And I think, you know, when we request today that the Department of Veterans Affairs, that we meet to discuss the Department of Veterans Affairs and vote on more funding, that there shouldn't be an issue. If Republicans can find hundreds of millions of dollars to eliminate the personal property tax for some businesses, then they should be able to find a few million dollars for our veterans at a minimum. And I would say we should go much further than that.
So I am curious, this letter that was sent to the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Dan Zimmerman, was from Democratic members of the Joint Finance Committee. Have you talked with your Republican colleagues? Is there a reason why they weren't included on that, why they didn't sign on?
So when we sent this letter last week, I believe some of my colleagues on the budget committee were actually in Colorado for an ALEC conference. So I frankly have not seen many of them in the building recently. And when they have been, they've been meeting behind closed doors. And that speaks to a larger point. We should be having these meetings in the open. We should have a public notice. And I personally believe every member of the Finance Committee should sit down and listen to the people of Wisconsin while we have this impasse. So it's certainly not for a lack of trying. We do want these issues to be bipartisan, but sometimes it can be hard to find our colleagues who tend to be arguing with themselves behind closed doors.
Well, and you mentioned that the current budget has not been passed. We're 25 days over at this point. There are budget impasses on transportation, on taxes, on education. The Republicans are, as you said, kind of fighting with themselves. Have any of the Republican factions' positions reached out to Democrats? Because it seems like there's an opportunity for Democrats to sway things one way or the other.
Absolutely. There is an opportunity. And I think most people of the state want bipartisan action. They want us to invest in opportunities for everyone in Wisconsin to succeed. They want us to reward hard work and make sure that everyone has the ability to see a budget that works for them. And unfortunately, I would say, you know, there has been ample opportunity over the last few months to reach out to Democrats. We've continued to ask for a seat at the table, especially when it comes to education financing. We put out our own plan that lowers property taxes and invests more in our kids, especially when it comes to roads. It should be noted that if August 8th comes and we still don't have a budget, we're going to see project delays. And that costs the state money, that costs taxpayers, that costs construction workers. So we don't want to see that. We want to end this budget impasse. But unfortunately, Democrats haven't been invited to the table. And once we get there, you know, if there is bipartisan agreement, that would be ideal. But I assume, given the fact that they've mostly been spending time behind closed doors with each other, they're sort of arguing amongst themselves.
Representative Shanklin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Representative Katrina Shanklin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. She joined us today to talk about a letter she co-signed with other Democratic members of the Joint Finance Committee requesting more funds for veteran services in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll find out how Madison did in the annual African American History Challenge Bowl, which they've dominated in the past. Stay with us here on Central Time. If you think about national champions in Wisconsin, you might think of Badger Athletics, the Packers, or maybe the UW-Whitewater's men's and women's wheelchair basketball teams. But here's another to add to the list. Madison's teams are the ones to beat at the annual African American History Challenge Bowl, which is sponsored by the national organization 100 Black Men. 2017 was no exception, with Madison's Wright Middle School coming out on top earlier this summer in New Orleans. Enos Ragland has been involved with Madison's chapter of 100 Black Men since its founding and brought along team member Jaden Wynn to talk with us. Jaden, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Enos, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Enos, how long has the African American History Challenge Bowl been around?
Well, it was started by the National 100 Black Men of America about 20 years ago as an effort to get more of our youth involved in academics and compete academically. And we've been participating for 19 years as a local chapter here in Madison.
And how do students get to be on the team, Enos?
We have a citywide competition. We have a great partnership with the Madison Metropolitan School District and Dr. Jennifer Cheatham. And we organize a citywide competition. So every middle school, we have 12 middle schools, and they all participate in the local African American History Challenge Bowl. And then we take the winners to the national championship, wherever it is. It moves around from year to year at the national conference.
And about how many teams end up at the national challenge?
It varies from year to year. It depends on the location, the individual finances of that particular chapter, a lot of different factors go into how many teams are compete every year. So it varies. Sometimes there's been like 15 or 20. Other times there's 6 to 8. But it's always a spirited competition.
I can imagine. And what's the age range of the students who are participating?
Well, there are two separate tiers. One is seniors, which is high school students, and then the junior division, which is middle school students. And we focus on middle school students as, you know, the group that we want to assist in learning more about our history and competing academically.
So, Jaden, how did you get involved? This was the Wright Middle School team that you were on. How did you get involved?
Well, so my social studies teacher, he picked a couple few students who seemed intrigued or more passionate about social studies, and he said he does this thing called the African American History Bowl, and so at once a week for like 3 years, we go in and we study a whole bunch of questions, and we just learned a lot, and so then for first, I was originally going to be the extra, but one of the contestants who moved away to Denmark, Soren, and so I had to like step up my game and I had to catch up with Micah, and I guess everything turned out well, as you probably know. And then so we went to the competition, we won, and then after that, like 3 months, it was in April, and we left in June. So however many months after that, we had to like study and study like twice as hard because we had to know the questions in more depth. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we kind of overstudied because like it wasn't in that much depth, and like a lot of things that we really studied in depth, they didn't end up being on the bowl, but we still knew the stuff. So that turned out well.
So how much do you know in advance, Jaden? Like, do they give you certain topics or certain periods? Because African-American history is a really big field to be studying.
Well, it's a book by Henry Louis Gates, Life Upon These Shores. So he stopped writing it in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected. And it starts all the way back in 1619, where the slave ship, the White Lion, brought the first 16 slaves over from Africa to Jamestown, Virginia. And it's just that entire time period from 1619 to 2008.
Wow, that's a lot. I majored in history. I know that's a big chunk of time to be able to master. Was there a particular time period or group of events or people in that you were studying that you especially enjoyed learning about?
I always like learning about. I liked it all, but I like learning about the segregation in the 50s and like. The Great Migration and the movements of African Americans and how they're progressing and how they basically kind of like built up the economy and stuff.
So, Enos, what's the format of the actual competition?
Well, it's based on a College Bowl format, where if you remember the old College Bowl, where you have to hit the buzzer to buzz in to be able to answer the question. If you get the question right, then you get the points. If you don't, then you can lose points. Mm. If you get the question wrong, then the other team gets an opportunity to answer the question. So it's a pretty intense competition, and it's very competitive. And we appreciate the commitment that young people like Jaden and others throughout Madison School District have committed to this, as well as the teachers and the parents. Mm-hmm. And it's open to every student, any student. It's not just African-American students, because we feel it's important that everyone understands and learns our culture as well.
Sure. And so, Jaden, it sounds like besides having to know the material, there's also some strategy involved in whether you buzz in or not. Is that something that you and your teammates would talk about?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot because a lot of times it was a trick, because they say the question, it sounds like a certain answer, but then if we would just listen to the question, it would be something completely different. But then I just didn't want to give the other team a chance, so like a few times I'd ring it, and then like, but then they'd say like the last two words of the question, it would totally throw off my mind, and then we really had to think, and like one out of the three times it happened, and like the one in New Orleans, we got it right, but we won anyway, so I guess it's all right.
So New Orleans, I'm glad you brought that up, Jaden, because the national championship was in New Orleans this year. Was that the first time that you had been down there?
I've been down south. I've been to Louisiana, but I've never been to New Orleans, and I like New Orleans. It was a very great and interesting experience.
So what was it like? I mean, you competed. You obviously did really well here in Madison, that your team got to go to New Orleans. But what was it like knowing you were up against, you know, other really great teams? Did you have a lot of nerves? Or
yeah, we were nervous. So like before we won, we were like trying to convince ourselves to also have fun. We were just nervous all the time, and so we were just studying. We just wanted to learn it all in depth. And like on the plane, we were studying, and so but then like when we actually won, we felt pretty good about it because. Well, we won. And so then, like, for the rest of the time, we got to feel happy about it and, like, not be so nervous.
Tell
so,
her what happened on the plane.
With the flight attendant lady?
Yes.
So, like, our like, other kind of, like, tutor-type person, Emmanuel, also a mentor of the 100 Black Men, basically everybody we met that asked where we were going, he'd say, we're going to a national competition in New Orleans. And she'd say, what for? African-American history. And so then she started quizzing us on stuff, and we got it right. And then she went on the loudspeaker and, like, said, everybody, these students, and she had to remember our names. She struggled with that. But she remembered our names, and then she just shouted us out on the loudspeaker on the plane, and it was just crazy.
Did people applaud for you?
Yeah, people applauded, but now... we wrote a letter to her to tell her that we won because she was really wanted us to win.
And so this was on the way down that she did that. Oh.
Yes.
It was crazy because everybody we meet, they say, don't come home without a trophy. You got this, guys. Just building up our nerve every time they talk to us. I just look at Mike and Pawan. We just had fear in our eyes.
No pressure, right?
Yeah.
But you did win. And that's, first of all, congratulations. And Enos, this is not that unusual. Madison really dominates this competition.
Yes, we have been, we've won the national competition, I believe it's 5 times now. And we've come in second at least 4 or 5 times over the 19 years that we've participated in it. And It's a credit to our school system and our students and the parents and the coaches who commit to working with our youth to bring home the trophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are known as one of the powerhouses in the organization for the African American History Challenge Bowl.
There are so many issues that 100 Black Men works on or is interested in, and certainly even more issues out in the community that could be worked on. How important is it for 100 Black Men of Madison to continue supporting these efforts of students like Jaden and the parents and the teachers to continue working on the African American History Challenge Bowl?
Well, we have a commitment to the youth and to our community, and we believe that if anyone should step up to the forefront to help, particularly our African American youth who are having a difficult time in our society these years, it should be African American men. And so we are an organization of men of means, and we use our resources and our connections to help our youth. This is just one component of what we do in the community, the African American History Challenge Bowl. And it's important, we believe, that our young people learn to compete academically. We learn and to compete athletically, but to compete academically is different, and to not be intimidated by tests and academic pursuits. And so that's important because many times many of our kids lack the psychological confidence to succeed and compete. And so that's important.
So, Jaden, you were an eighth grader at Wright Middle School here in Madison when you competed. Now you're going to high school. You'll be at Memorial in the fall. Do you feel like competing and winning has given you some confidence as you start this big new adventure?
Well, I always believed myself to be a confident person because I'm not a very shy person. But, like, after winning, like, not many things make me as nervous anymore. Like, normally I'd be, like, super nervous to talk on the radio. But, like, being in front of all those people and, like, really studying and just not wanting to fail really, like, makes you less nervous about other things, even if they're, like, really cool, like talking on the radio or something. So I guess I am more confident going into high school.
Well, Enos, thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
And Jaden, congratulations again, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Enos Ragland of Madison's chapter of 100 Black Men came by with Jaden Nguyen to talk about Madison's win in this year's African American History Challenge Bowl. Jaden was on the Wright Middle School team that represented the city in New Orleans. He'll be attending Memorial High School in the fall. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the stand-up comedy boom and its influence. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Stand-up has a special place in the American comedic tradition, but the craft hasn't always been the most prestigious one, but that's changing. It seems like comedians have ascended to a new level of popularity. They have massive social media followings, Netflix specials, and they even perform at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Here's a clip of comedian Hasan Minhaj telling jokes at the dinner. He stood behind the podium the president traditionally would have been behind.
I get it. We gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke.
Joining us now to talk more about the comedy boom is Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hi, good to have you with us. Do you think it's fair to say that we're living in a golden age of comedy?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. But for me, maybe it's a comedic instinct that makes me a little paranoid. I think, you know, after every golden age, when things are, after anything going too well, there's going to be a crash to the boom, if that makes any sense. So I'm very excited, but also a little fearful.
Kind of looking, worried that you're looking over the precipice, maybe.
Exactly.
So looking back at the history of comedy in America, are there other times in American history that we've seen comedy booms like this?
Definitely in the 80s, which was what you might call the comedy club boom. Comedy was on the rise, that, of course, crashed. And I think now, because of social media and podcasting and all these new avenues for getting connecting with people and viewing entertainment, there is, you know, naturally, you know, comedy is important. And then with the political climate right now, it's almost like comedy is more relevant. Like, we're seeking these people to make some sense of it all. And in some ways, comedians are held more accountable than politicians now. And I think all of this is sort of happening all at once. And that's where we're at now.
Going back to that comedy club boom and then bust, as you said, what was it about that particular, I don't know if type of comedy or type of presenting comedy, that it wasn't sustainable, that there was a bust at the end?
I don't know if you can blame it on the type of comedy. I think it was just something where, you know, a lot of comedy clubs were opening up at that point. And, you know, when things become too accessible, I think it becomes common to people and it becomes something that isn't as exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think all of that came into play. And, you know, now I think in hindsight, you look at the past of anything, you can kind of turn things into a caricature. And so, you know, there definitely is this idea of the sort of hack 80s comic. And maybe a little bit of that was at play. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to tell, to be honest.
So looking back at the 90s, a lot of those comics who were making names for themselves on that comedy club circuit and were out doing shows, TV network executives were really eager to throw sitcom deals their way. I'm thinking of Jerry Seinfeld, Roseanne Barr, Tim Allen, even going back to the 80s and Bill Cosby. What strikes you as different about this age of comedy?
I think there's a lot of behind the scenes work that people have the opportunity to work on. I mean, I cannot even count the number of comedy programs that exist right now, be it late night television, be it comedy shows on things like Netflix and Hulu. I mean, I don't think every comic right now even wants a sitcom deal. I think there are so many different ways that you can even present your stand-up to an audience. It doesn't have to be you in a microphone. It can be you without a microphone. It can be, you know, PowerPoint heavy. It can be almost like a TED talk. And there's no such thing as just, you know, going on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and getting a sitcom deal right after. I think, you know, sometimes, you know, I think you do a late night set and you maybe get 50 followers on Twitter afterwards, and a few more people know your name, and you get to get a little bit closer to getting, you know, getting your name out there. It's not as cut as dry as it used to be, but the plus side is that there's so much more opportunity, and it might not be a sitcom on one of the major networks, but you could get a really cool web series out there. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, kind of just as important and just as valuable.
We're talking with Tim Barnes right now. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. And we're talking about the current boom in comedy. And would you say that stand-up comedy, that being in front of a live audience and having that really pretty intimate interaction with them, is it gaining more respect as a performing art?
I think so. I think audiences value a live experience more than ever. And I think about this even with the number of comedy specials that are coming out now. Like, there was a time where a comedy special meant it came out in a movie theater and you were still with an audience of strangers watching the special. I think about the classic, you know, Richard Pryor specials, Live on the Sunset Strip. Even when The Kings of Comedy came out, that was an event. You went to the movie theater to try to get the closest thing to the experience of seeing these comedians live on stage. And now when I watch stand-up, I'm usually alone in my room, maybe have my girlfriend with me, maybe, you know, like one other person. And I don't know if it's because I'm a comedian and I'm jaded, but I'm not, you know, I'm just kind of analyzing it. I'm not laughing. I'm not getting that sort of social feedback. And I think because stand-up is so much about this sort of social feedback, you know, some jokes can be something that you won't laugh at alone, but something about hearing a joke in front of an audience makes you realize, like, oh, there is something I didn't notice about that. Someone can tell a joke that I wouldn't laugh at alone, but all of a sudden I'm at a show and I realize that a lot of women in the audience are laughing at this joke because this means something. And it's sort of an eye-opening experience. And I think all of that kind of stuff is so important to everybody right now.
And Tim, let's flip it around, because you are a performing stand-up comic. What is it about that energy, that attention, that connection with the audience that hooks you as a comic?
Oh, me as a comic? Oh, my God. Before I ever did stand-up, every public speaking experience I had was a disaster. Like, I have very vivid memories of doing, you know, reports in front of the classroom, sort of like things where you had to, you know, do stuff in front of all the other parents, and I'd just be crying. I was stuttering, I was crying. And there's something about getting this opportunity to make a point and getting a specific reaction from it. I consider myself to be a pretty quiet person, more of a watcher, someone who in most conversations, I don't get to get my point through for some odd reason. And stand-up has been that one opportunity for me to do that. And I really do think that is the center of why I get joy out of it. I don't know if that's every comedian, but that's me.
But you say you're more of a watcher. Isn't that really key to being a good comic? Don't you have to be able to pull out those observations? I mean, that's what usually gets people laughing, whether self-consciously or with the realization, like, oh my gosh, I never put that together, or I never, you know, pulled that out of this experience that we've all had.
Oh, definitely. That's definitely an important part of it. And, you know, I don't know if you know too many quiet people, if you're a quiet person yourself, but quiet people have sort of a secret language. And I think
I am not fluent in that secret language. What is it?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. It's just something where, you know, I can meet another quiet person and just give a certain kind of eye contact and just we'll be laughing at each other because we're seeing this thing. We're not experiencing it the way most people are. And I think it might be a cliche that, you know, a lot of people say stand-ups are introverts, but it's very interesting when you get stand-up comics to talk to each other because we're kind of skipping parts of conversations that normal people have. Like, we're just trying to get to the punchline. We're not trying to have this sort of fluffy small talk. We're trying to, like, it's all sort of set up punchline. And I think it's because we're a little annoyed by the inconvenience that a lot of people have to go through, the sort of procedure of conversation and just doing normal things that we have to do as human beings.
We're talking with Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True. It features interviews with various comedians. We're looking at the stand-up comedy boom in recent years and how the art has a renewed level of popularity. And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're living in a golden age of comedy? Who are your favorite comedians from the past or present? And how do you think comedy has changed? Tell us how comedy has influenced you and the person you are today. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. We're looking at the recent boom in comedy, especially in stand-up. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're living in a new golden age of comedy? And do you think comedy is more or less influential today than it used to be? If you're a comedian, we'd love to hear about your comedy and where you get your inspiration. And do you find that comedy has become more diverse? And has that affected your interest in it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And do you think that comedy has gotten more diverse, Tim? Are we looking at a much wider range of people and experiences that are being brought to comedy?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I feel like I'm probably an example of that. And I know you played that Hasan Minhaj clip earlier. I mean, that's another example. And for me personally, before I started doing stand-up, it took part of why we are in this quote-unquote golden age right now for me to feel like, okay, I think I can do this. Because when Conan moved from NBC to TBS, and this is just part of this new landscape of so many late night television shows, I feel like one great thing about that is that he got to highlight so many stand-up comics on his TBS late night show than he ever did on NBC, and probably highlights more stand-up comics than any other late night show right now. And some of the performers that he had on there are like part of this new wave, people like Pete Holmes, people like TJ Miller, people like Ron Funches. And when Ron Funches went on Conan, that was an eye-opening experience for me, because that was one of the first times that I really saw a black person on stage who was so very weird and so very charming at the same time. And, you know, wasn't wearing a suit, you know, wasn't the sort of cool, collected comedian like Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle. And that's part of this new world of comedy right now. You can express yourself comedically in ways that aren't as pigeonholed as they were before. You know, I don't feel the need to go to chocolate sundaes at a comedy club. Although I do wish some comedy clubs had Wonder Bread Wednesdays. I think that would be wonderful.
Well, you mentioned Ron Funches, and we actually have a clip, so let's give a listen to that.
I left Chicago because there's a lot of gangs and violence. I did not know the Northwest also had gangs. They are not scary or effective. But they try so hard. I even ran into a gang on the Oregon coast, of all places. And I don't like to be racist, but it was a gang of blackbirds. A real murderer's row.
That, again, was Ron Funches, who you said, Tim, was influential for you. Is the fact that comedy is getting more diverse kind of giving everyone, whether they're male, female, white, black, anything, kind of more room to be themselves?
Yes. Short answer, yes. And I think, you know, there's sort of two sides to this coin when it comes to, you know, is social media a hindrance or is it a crutch for new comedians? I think, you know, social media in a lot of ways, having a Twitter account and testing out jokes and seeing who interacts with it is great for me and for a lot of people to really get their voice out there. And sort of like on that note, you know, I started doing stand-up 5 or 6 years ago, and through social media, I became sort of, you know, acquaintances with Ron Funches, and I even got to interview him on my podcast. And social media, I think, is an opportunity for a lot of people from diverse backgrounds to get their voice out there. You can get, you know, popular, you can become noticed, you can get asked to write for a television show because of it. I think, you know, this new way of communication has just been a great thing.
And we mentioned earlier that Netflix and other ways of delivering content is really picking up on the popularity of comedians, and that, you know, it used to be maybe a special or two a year came out that featured stand-up comedy, and now it's, you know, on a weekly basis, there's something new to watch, new comics to be introduced to. Here's a clip of a promo of Hannibal Buress's Netflix special.
The weirdest thing about getting a death threat from a male bodybuilder slash stripper on Facebook is when you click on his profile and see that you have one mutual friend.
That was Hannibal Buress. So what does it mean for comics, you know, who are, or people who are considering comedy as something they want to, you know, spend their time on and perform? What does it mean to see so many comics getting what used to be the big break that was maybe limited to very few people?
I think it changes the goal setting. It's harder to become, you know, it makes it more difficult in some ways to become, you know, some people want to be the next Chris Rock. You know, there's probably five Chris Rocks right now. I saw an article, I think it was on Splitsider a couple months ago. I might be saying it wrong, but it was something like the best stand-up specials of May. Something like that. And I thought, that's so wonderful, but also so frightening.
Mm-hmm. Next, there'll be the best stand-up specials of Tuesday.
Yeah, of May? There's so many stand-up specials out there. So, like, for new comics, it's great because you can, like, really just watch professionals and take notes and, you know, think about what you like and what you don't like about this. And every stand-up comic has imagined their comedy special, and this just makes that, you know, easier for you to sort of, you know, get accumulated to all this and figure out what you want to do. But again, I don't know if it's because I'm a comedian, but I don't know who's watching these, mm-hmm. these, because I watch some of them, some of the bigger ones, but it's harder because it's just so much easier for me to go to a show that a friend is doing than to watch a special. And I'm curious, you know, as to, I think culturally, this is something that we're going to be writing about for a while, about why we're seeking comedy so much. In general, comedy connects the dots, and it's so much harder for us to connect the dots with all of the news we're getting day to day. And hopefully the comedy that's being produced is a helpful distraction. Hopefully it's a distraction that in some subversive way educates and informs people. And, you know, we're getting some solid, something truly nourishing from this new golden age of comedy.
So comedy can be a distraction and a nourishment, but it can also be kind of therapy, can't it? And comedy and politics are so closely intertwined. We're in a really polarized political climate right now. Who do you think is really capitalizing as comedians on the politics of today?
I mean, definitely people like John Oliver, Trevor Noah, all of the politically, you know, aligned comedy programs. I think, you know, it's also funny to see how some people create a marketing strategy around it. It's like, I'd be curious to know how I'd be curious to see what, you know, Bill Maher's angle would be if Hillary Clinton were president, you know. And I think, you know, Donald Trump has become a bit of a crutch, perhaps, mm-hmm. to comedy. Like, and you can almost predict the Donald Trump joke that's coming up oftentimes. But I think that's just where we're at right now. And I hope that in a couple months we'll be able to dive a little bit deeper, we'll get over our shock, and really focus on some substantive stuff. And trust me, there is comedy there as well. There's comedy in the cracks that we aren't focusing on.
And you talked earlier, Tim, about after every boom, not just in comedy, but other things, it seems like there are busts coming not far behind. What do you think could happen that would create a bust for this current comedy boom?
That's a tough one.
Is it maybe the saturation that you were kind of hinting at?
It is the saturation. And I think, you know, what I've laid out here throughout this entire conversation is my not being able to understand why certain people are seeking out comedy so much. And again, that's probably just because comedy has become a sort of second nature to me. Mm-hmm. But definitely I see, you know, this oversaturation as being, as having, it's going to have a backlash, and maybe I should study drama at some point.
Well, Tim, this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Tim Barnes is a stand-up comic, podcast producer, and host of It's All True. It's a podcast that features interviews with various comedians. He joined us to talk about the comedy boom, especially the stand-up comedy boom, and how the industry has changed. And we want to know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page. What comedy is really appealing to you right now? What makes for good comedy in your mind? And have you ever done stand-up? Again, share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. Whether from your own childhood or from reading to your kids, you've probably seen the book The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. Well, new research from UW-Madison says that under some conditions, caterpillars are not only hungry, they can get hangry like people do, and it can get pretty ugly. University of Wisconsin-Madison integrated biology professor John Orrick just published a research paper that showed that when plants protect themselves by making themselves taste bad, caterpillars look for other sources of food. And when they're hungry enough, that other food might be the caterpillar next to them. Orrick said, quote, "It often starts with one caterpillar biting another one in the rear, which then oozes, and it goes downhill from there. At the end of the day, somebody gets eaten." Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.